Stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. A huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
This is the Vorpal Network.
Well, this is Ethan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I am here with Mr. John Rogers. How are you doing, John?
Very good, Ethan. Thanks for talking to me.
No problem. Thank you for being on the show. Now, for those people who might not know who Mr. John Rogers is, if anyone has heard of a little show on TNT called Leverage, then they're familiar with his work. John, you're a producer and a writer and even sometimes director, aren't you?
I actually co-created the show with Chris Downey, and then I directed the... So I've been running the writer's room with him for the last 3 years, and then directed my first episode this year.
Excellent, excellent. And I guess some people might be asking, why in God's green earth am I having you on a gaming podcast? And that's because, well, you're a huge gamer.
Those people would be fools. They'd be mad fools. I'm a giant geek.
Yes. How did you get into the to gaming, into the gaming hobby? What got you started on this long road of decadence
I started with AD&D back in the day. Uh-huh. And then I became a road comic. And when you're a road comic, it's very hard to find, you don't have a regular schedule. So I didn't really play for my 20s. That's when I got into Magic, just so, it was always very easy at that time in particular to blow into town, and you'd work these clubs for like a week, and you'd find the local hobby shop, and you'd be able to play Magic, during the day, mm-hmm. or before you did the shows at night. And you could always travel with like two or three decks, and so I'd have a couple different decks with me, and it just broke up the travel. And then when I moved to LA, the guys who produced one of my first movies, Andy Cosby and Ross Ritchie, who went on to create Boom Studios, the comic book company, mm-hmm. Told me that they had actually started up a D&D campaign back in the day. And so, because rather than poker, they were like, it was a funny story because they were going, they're playing poker, and they said in the old days we'd be playing D&D, and one of them said, well, why don't we? And everyone sort of looked around and went, wow, we can, can't we? So they started a game, I hopped on. And so I've been playing off and on now for like the 10 years since I've been in L.A.
Makes sense. So you're out of Los Angeles, or you're living...
Out of Los Angeles now. Yeah, I lived in New York for a while when I worked on Cosby, and then moved out here when I got my first deal.
So, well, for the benefit of our listeners, what have you worked on? You've done the Cosby,
I was a staff writer on Cosby, not the first show that made everyone rich and famous, the second one that ended lives and careers. And then I was one of the guys who wrote the first draft of Transformers. I did the core. I wrote, co-created Blue Beetle with Keith Giffen, the relaunch with Jaime Reyes. I created Leverage. I did the aborted pilot to Global Frequency, the Warren Ellis, comic book. I did the pilot for that, and just been basically writing genre television and movies for 10 years or so.
Excellent. Now, it sounds like you've worked in a lot of different fields. Obviously, television and film, and also you mentioned Blue Beetle. You've worked in the comic industry a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm just starting to do gaming stuff now. I've done, I wrote for, I playtested 4th edition, and then I've written some stuff for the 4th edition for the Manual of the Planes and also for the strategy guide.
Okay, cool. Have you found any significant sort of challenges writing for any particular medium, jumping from one to the other?
Well, it's everyone has a different thing. With movies, it's patience, just because the production cycle on a movie is so long. You're dealing with such a big machine to get going. You know, you're very much a cog in this sort of giant beast. Mm-hmm. With television, it's the speed of the production cycle. Once you're up and running, once you get a show up, you know, you shoot that show week in, week out, regardless of whether you have a bad week, if you have writer's block, it doesn't matter, you know. And we call it the train, and you just keep laying track in front of the train until it stops.
Right.
And you just, you know, try to make, you know, it's not like England where you write the whole series before it starts shooting, you know, which is a great luxury. We're actually often writing the episode that starts shooting next week, you know, as we've written episodes of Leverage, broken it in 24 hours, outlined in 24 hours, and written 24 hours, and 72 hours later it's being shot, you know, just crazy scheduling. And then for comics, it's just the sheer difficulty of the writing. Not everyone writes comics this way, but, you know, the way I was taught, you're actually editing, writing, and directing at the same time. So you're calling every shot. Pardon me, you're designing the pages. You know, you're doing a lot of creative input that's like directing in television, but with even more, you know, even more of a hassle.
Cool. Now, with you mentioned Blue Beetle, and I want to go back to that because a friend of mine is huge fan of the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle.
Oh, cool!
I am sadly very uneducated in the forms of Blue Beetle and quite a lot of the DC comics. How did that come about in developing a new take on Blue Beetle? Because that was after. The original Blue Beetle had been killed, I believe. That was
after the second Blue Beetle, Ted Kord was brutally slain at the end of, I think, Identity Crisis, or I can't remember which crossover to lead into Final Crisis.
Yeah, it was. I know what you're talking about. I have just recently read that one too, and I can't remember the name. But yes.
So, well, what happened is Ted Kord was also a favorite hero of mine because he was a science hero, you know, and part of a really well written Justice League run by Keith Giffen. And I actually, ironically, Keith knew me because he'd read my adaptation of Matt Wagner's Mage and really loved the screenplay, even though it was never shot. He always thought it was the best adaptation he'd ever read. Mm-hmm. And right after they shot Ted Kord, I wrote a scathing blog post about the brutality of the current DC editorial board. And so what happened was Keith, being Keith, emailed me and said, listen, they said I can work with somebody on this. How would you like to work for them and help build something since you hate what they're doing? And you know, full credit to DC and Dan DiDio. He's like, all right, man, put your money where your mouth is. Come on onto the team. So, you know, I sat at Keith's knee and learned for the first 7-8 issues, and then I did my first solo issue, and then I took over the title right around issue 10-11. And I was on for the first 2 years.
The whole first 2 years of the
My last issue was issue 25, I believe, and then it ran through issue 36, which was nice because it was actually a pretty long run for a mid-list character at the time. And then, of course, you know, Jaime, it was nice because we designed him not to be a crossover character. We really designed him to be the fresh-faced young hero of the DC universe,
right,
who did not hang out with the other superheroes. And ironically, that created a really nice character for other writers to use because, you know, all the other characters have been kicking around forever. So whenever you needed a fresh face, they went to Jaime. Mm-hmm. So he became a pretty popular character and then eventually wound up on The Brave and the Bold, which is a very good, a really great cartoon show they're doing for
Yeah, he's been on there a few times now, I think.
He's become a pretty beloved character, and it's just nice, you know, my buddy Chris Downey, the other co-creator of Leverage, his son's Blue Beetle is Jaime. You know, that's the only Blue Beetle he's ever known and thinks he's cool. And that's
very
kind
nice.
Of, you know, the downside of working for a big publishing company is you don't own it. The upside being was part of this tradition that, you know, will live on long beyond you.
Sure. Is that how you found working on a television show sort of like Leverage?
Leverage, you know, is the difference between working on a show that where you're just staffing like I did with Cosby, or where you're consulting, which I did with Eureka, and when you created it. I mean, you know, when you create the show, you really feel like, okay, once you're past the pilot, once you're into season, you know, 3 or 4, you're making something there's going to be fans of forever.
Right.
You know, there's going to be people who go, oh, God, remember that show, Leverage? I love that show. You know, and they're going to get the DVDs, and they're going to show each other the episodes, and you know, it, in particular, like Beth Riesgraf's character Parker, you feel you've made an archetype that other writers and other shows will wind up using.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's nice. It is, you know, what the whole Samuel Johnson quote, "No one but a blockhead ever wrote, but for money." But there's still a pretty nice sense of satisfaction out of that.
Excellent. Now, have you found that you tap into any of those reservoirs from, like, you know, comics, movies, TV when you're at the gaming table?
Oh yeah, it's all storytelling. You know, and certainly when I'm at the gaming table, and vice versa. You know, I always the leader, Tim Hutton's character Nathan Ford, lives in a condo over an Irish bar. Mm-hmm. And they meet the clients downstairs. And I like to say that Leverage is a team of adventurers who get a job in a pub every week. You know, it is as close to Orkin Pie as you can possibly get in mainstream television. Except the Ork is an evil businessman and the pie is the insurance payout for the client. You know, it's all storytelling. You know, it's definitely, you know, when I game, I tend to do very fast-paced stuff, very character-driven stuff, the same stuff that I like to write. You know, and I have friends who are novelists and that sort of thing who do long, very drawn-out character studies and that sort of thing. And that's related to the style that they write their other media in. You know, everyone has the same toolbox in different media, and they just kind of carry it from place to place. Mm-hmm. You know, and definitely it cross-pollinates. You know, I think I'm far more comfortable writing a five-person show because I'm used to seeing people bring 5 to 6 characters alive and keep them vibrant, and understanding that if they're different enough, each one can shine. You know, that's a very gaming style.
Mm-hmm. And also with Leverage is now being developed and coming out as a role-playing game from Margaret Weiss Productions. Yeah. Did you have anything, any sort of hand in that?
No. They licensed it out, and it was one of those things where, you know, the company came to me and said, "We licensed it out for a game." I went, "Oh, guys, you should have called me. I mean, you know, I'm a giant geek. It's this Margaret Weiss company. Oh, it's great." You know, it was just one of those, "Oh, wow, I love Cortex." I mean, I was hoping they'd use Cortex System, and they did, you know. And I've seen big chunks of it, and it's great. I mean, I think they've really kind of broken the back of con and heist-style gaming. Mm-hmm. Which has been the holy grail for a long time.
Sure.
Very much in the way that they've got kind of role-based skills, and they've done really, you know, the Cortex system lends itself to that kind of playing, that kind of trading advantages and helping each other out, very story-based trading.
Sure.
You know, Cortex, and I gotta say Savage Worlds is my favorite design system right now. I play 4th Ed and really dig it, but I really like Cortex a lot. It and Savage Worlds are, of course, very close cousins.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. With working on the television show Leverage, and it being a 5-person sort of ensemble type of cast, have you found yourself throwing any game related things into the show or into any of your writing?
Oh God! Well, I mean, you know, if you're talking just, you know, there's a couple different ways to take that, but you know, there's an extended riff first season where Hardison, our hacker, you know, missed his deadline in the morning because it was up all night with the new WoW expansion.
Right.
you know, the when Hardison threw up a fist bumped the girl at the office and said, "For the Horde," I think we got another million fans right off that. yeah, I mean, you know, we ended one of the episodes where he and Elliot had attempted to go fishing. It had gone wrong with him setting up a Wii fishing thing in their office on their big giant screen that they used to do their briefings for of Evil on. You know, he's 24 and he's a gamer, and you know, that's, we don't go out of our way to peg it, but if it makes sense for that to be the thing he's talking about, that's what he's going to talk about. And that to me is the whole thing about doing geek culture on TV. You know, I'm a fairly successful 40-year-old geek who has a wife and a nice life and a nice house, and you know, it's just part of your life. It's not this defining thing it was in the representations in the culture for so long.
Sure.
So, you know, I if it's appropriate that a well-adjusted human being on TV talks about gaming, then we do it, because, you know, that can just be part of their life.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to put my entertainment hat on real quick here. Looking down your resume, you've done a lot of writing for you have a lot of writing credits for a lot of different movies, including like the first Transformers movie you mentioned.
Yeah.
What was that like working on? I mean that in and of itself, Transformers, huge, a huge property and a huge icon for so many kids.
Well, I mean that was crazy because they brought me in. I'd written something else. I produced something and written something for Steven Spielberg to direct. Lord, here he gets around to it. It's a great movie. But anyway, they brought me in because they said, listen, we have the license to Transformers. And, you know, they had all these Transformers in the office. And, you know, we want you to take a shot at it. And I went, you know, I don't really know the franchise. And they said, you've just spent the last 5 minutes playing with Optimus Prime while we've been talking. Listen, we need a geek. We need someone we don't have to brief. So I took the first run at it. And, you know, it was one of those things where you come up with the idea and then you go pitch a giant table of Hasbro executives.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, I remember the pitch went very well. And they said, well, when are we looking at releasing this? They said, well, the July weekend that they did. And so based on the special effects schedule, when do we have to have the script done? And as they rolled back through the production deadlines, that date came closer and closer to the point where the producer said, so we should have had a script yesterday, like in theory, to get to this release date. And that's what it was. I mean, and if you don't want to play this game, then don't write these movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's what the paycheck's for. You know, if you write the artsy stuff for free. You know, you get paid the sort of money you get paid to write these movies because they go, you know, you're already 2 months behind. Get started.
Sure.
And certainly there was a certain amount of stress. And there was one point, my wife will tell you, I woke up at 5 a.m. Clutching my chest and going, which one's the jet? Like just in a total panic mode of I couldn't remember what character was what while I was writing. And then, you know, I turned it in. They really liked it. They said, we got a director, Michael Bay. He's got these other two guys who just did The Island with. And, you know, and I knew that I was not going to be. Hold on a second. I got to check that. Could you hold on?
Sure.
Yeah, hard out. Anyway, you know, then he brought on Alex and Bob, you know, Kurtzman and Orsi, who'd done great work, and they did the production with Michael. But, you know, here's the thing. You're never the last guy on in those movies. It's just not how it works. You know, you're just one of the, you know, the dudes whose name is on the poster.
Mm-hmm.
If you're lucky. And, you know, I've been on movies. You know, I was one of the last guys on Catwoman, and there were 20 guys who worked on that over a 10-year span.
Yes, I've been
fortunate enough to be one of the ones whose name wound up on it.
Yeah, I have been threatened with bodily injury if I didn't ask you about Catwoman. So,
well, there's a you know, it's funny because I knew back in college there was this guy who was a screenwriter at McGill University, which had no screenwriting program. He invented it, and then he went on. I lost track of him for years, and it turned out it was Dan Waters, who of course wrote Heathers and then, you know, Batman Returns, and took a shot at Catwoman as a spinoff from Michelle Pfeiffer back in the 90s. And he said infamously, you know, this movie cannot be done. This is just impossible to do. And when I came onto the movie, it had been in development a long time. And there was a really awful draft right before mine where she lived in the suburbs and the bad guys had killed her mother for her washing machine designs. And I'm not shitting you. That was it.
Wow.
And, you know, the producer very cunningly said to me, she's like, you know, I just think you're the only person who can do this. It's really impossible. It's really tough to do. And I learned a lot later. Know the difference between a challenge and a warning. And I did not know that at that time. So I hopped on and spent 2 years trying to get that thing not to suck. And ultimately failed. And then, you know, I got it to the point where the director signed on. And the director signed on, and Halle Berry signed on, and then you know, Warner Brothers and I parted ways. I was like, well, they can't screw it up too badly in the, you know, 6 months before they start shooting, and they brought in like five other writers in that period of time. So, you know, on one hand, I wish my name wasn't on it. On the other hand, I put my name, you know, when they arbitrated, I put my name on it because I got the movie greenlit, and I spent 2 years in hell trying to get it made, so I wanted to get paid. You know, and I've used that money to do stuff like fund veterans charities and,
right.
you know, and pay for cool geek stuff that I want to pay for. So, you know, to support the community. So it's kind of a trade-off. I mean, you know, it's funny because I've never actually seen the movie. I just didn't go. And if I was telling that story one time at a barbecue, and I said, you know, I've never actually seen the movie. And Andy Cosby, who created Eureka, was walking behind me and said, isn't that like Hitler saying he's never actually seen the camps? I was like, yeah, nice. That's really sweet. Thanks, bud.
Ouch.
Yeah, you know what it reinforces? Nothing can end your career.
Yeah.
unless you cost people, and that's the thing is, you know, unless you cost people enormous amounts of money, you're fine. And almost every movie makes money. I tell you, Catwoman, horrible failure. I still get residual checks. It made its money back. You know, it's they all do eventually.
Do you find that at some point you either early on in your career or later on in your career, did you develop sort of a way just to disconnect yourself from projects like that?
No, because you have to care or you're a hack. You know, you have to really think that you're going to make the best version. I mean, I didn't spend 2 years on that movie not trying.
Sure.
You know, I spent 2 years in that movie busting my ass trying to really, really. You know, I designed a new costume for her that was basically what Darwin Cook wound up cooking up for his run. You know, I really wanted her to be a cool cat thief, you know, very much the character Parker is now on Leverage. Mm-hmm. And it's not what they were looking for. You know, Nolan hadn't come in and kind of reinvented the Bat franchise, and they were still kind of in Shoemaker land. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it really was, it was futile. But you can't not care. I mean, there's times that you learn maybe not to kill yourself.
Sure.
I mean, I was just working on a movie a little while ago, and I was, you know, really fighting for something. It was one of those moments where I realized, I'm not going to be the guy who solved this. I'm like first guy on. There's going to be 8 more writers on after me on this. So, you know, there's something I tell my younger writers on the show, which is pick your, you know, is this the hill you're going to die on? Is this the hill you're going to die on? Did you get one? And, you know, actually, 2 of my writers named their production company that. This is the Hill Productions. But that's what you really, you don't ever stop caring, but you do have to decide if this is the hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's I guess wisdom.
Well, looking at wrapping this up a little bit, I've got a few last questions that I try to ask the people on the show. Just a second.
No problem. Man.
I need to go strangle a dog. Hang on.
No problem.
All right. Well, as I was saying, sort of looking at wrapping things up here, is there anything sort of game-wise out there that you are excited about? You sort of mentioned Savage Worlds, but what have you found yourself playing, running, and really how has your time on, you know, on Leverage and on these other films sort of influenced the way you've played and the way you run games?
I'm relentless with pacing, just because, you know, especially in television, you have 2 minutes to get their attention and an act break every 12 minutes. So, you know, I tend to hit the ground running pretty hard. You wind up, your group winds up meeting while stuff is on fire.
Right.
you know, and then you get tossed in the deep end pretty quick. I remember the D&D campaign I ran, they actually met while they were in the middle of a retreat while their front line collapsed in a magical war. And they just, as each character ran for his life, he bumped into the next one. And they just, the entire group was running for the first half an hour of the game. You know, and that to me is, I write pulp. I love pulp. You know, mm-hmm. you know, I get, there's enough real world out there. I don't need to be depressed when I'm having my entertainment. You know, I like, you hit the ground running, stuff's on fire, you make big speeches, and beat the bad guy. So, you know, that's my sin. Love Fiasco. Haven't played it yet, but I read it, and it's just incredibly cool-looking story game. It was a big hit at Gen Con this year.
Mm-hmm. Were you at Gen Con?
No, I didn't get to go. I was shooting the finale.
Oh,
I'm the only executive producer in television who was disappointed he was actually directing part of his finale instead of being at Gen Con.
Oh, man,
Will Wheaton's there, and all my friends are there, and, you know.
Well, I guess it's one of those good problems, I think, to have.
Yeah, it's a rich guy's problem. It's not a bad one to have. But I missed Comic-Con and Gen Con this year, and I was pretty bummed. Fiasco is supposed to be really great. I've read it, and I adore the rules. I think it's really brilliantly done, and everyone who's played it loves it, so I can't wait to run that. I really love Savage Worlds for Speed of Play. I think it's just great for all genre. The new Supers Companion is just really underappreciated piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
I just got DC Adventures. I think Green Ronin's a really great company, and you know, DC Adventures is that's the Mutants and Masterminds third edition. That's a great, great system.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I've got. I picked it up at Gen Con. It was on my must-have list.
Yeah, and I wrote the introduction for one of their heroes books. The next book that's coming out, or their heroes collection.
The heroes and villains, I think, volume 1, something like that.
And you know, I'm writing the D&D comic for Wizards of the Coast that comes out in November, and it's very much written as a game session. It's very much written, you know.
And that's through IDW, isn't it?
That's through IDW. And it's interesting because, you know, some people read the 8-pager, which is always tough to do, and said, you know, it's kind of straight down the middle. And my thing is, well, yeah, because, you know, if you're you can't compete with fantasy literature. I mean, you know, there are fans of people play D&D who are into fantasy literature, and they're going to be reading Robert Jordan or George R.R. Martin, or I love Richard K. Morgan's new book, The Steel Remains. You know, that's the depth of fantasy fiction they want. Mm-hmm. What I'm aiming for is the casual gamer and casual comic fan. The comic fan who picks up the D&D comic goes, oh, I recognize this from Lord of the Rings. Like, my dad saw Lord of the Rings, right? My dad has never seen another fantasy movie or read another fantasy book in his life. He loves Lord of the Rings. So, you know, it's meant for someone to pick that up and go, oh, I recognize this. Elves, dwarves, banter, sword fighting, you know, funny conversation. And I picked, they offered me several of different of the universes, and I picked the tropiest, most straight down the middle I could, because I think that's the challenge, is taking it and making it the most, you know, interesting you can. So that's the big thing I'm in now, is fourth edition, kind of really, you know, getting into the guts of fourth edition, because I'm basically designing a big encounter every month. Mm-hmm. I still love fourth edition. I think it's a great system. I wish they'd universalize it. Unfortunately, the open gaming world has moved on. You know, with Pathfinder and stuff, fourth gen took a lot of the great stuff that Rodney Thompson and those guys did in Star Wars and really built on it. Mm-hmm. I think that version of Star Wars is really underappreciated gaming system, by the way.
The Saga Edition?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I've got a copy of it, haven't played it, but it is... one of my co-hosts is big into the old West End Games Star Wars.
Yeah. The D6s, yeah.
Looking through the Saga Edition, in my opinion, I think it's probably the most balanced and the best rendition of Star Wars that's out there.
Yeah, and it plays clean, and you can adapt it. I mean, that came the closest they had to like a fourth edition like modern gaming system. I really love fourth ed. I really dig it. I didn't think I'd like the power cards. I really love them. Mm-hmm. But I got to say, you know, it's kind of. Savage Worlds is about as close to the perfect gaming system as I can find.
Oh yeah, Shane over there
has
put together just a top-notch, elegant system.
Yeah,
a great book.
And the fact it hops so many genres, and you know, I ran a sample game once where I literally took every genre I could find: a vampire, giant robot, small robot, Sailor Moon, except they made it a 40-year-old man. Neo, Trinity from the Matrix. I put every single fictional character I could think of into it, and the system used them, integrated them all flawlessly. Excellent. It was really a great, a really beautifully designed system, and a great community, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any favorite settings for Savage Worlds that you're fond of?
I like Deadlands, of course. You know, Savage Worlds is kind of settings free, so yeah. I like.
Lot of choice out there.
Yeah. I think Reality Blurs did an amazing job with Realms of Cthulhu. That is a hell of a source book. It's well written. The plot point generators. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of great guys out there. The Thrilling Adventures guys did great work with their pulp version. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's been a definitive pulp version yet, but I think that's just because pulp is so many things to so many people.
Worlds does pulps extremely well, no matter really what you do. So.
And you can grid it up. I mean, I think one of the great things Reality Blurs came up with is, and in Realms, was the, you know, the sanity system and the physical danger system that is either gritty or pulpy or any combination thereof. And you've seen that system done in other games. Let me look over. I got my bookcase right over here. Hold on. Just looking. Great fantasy that the what was it, the Hellfrost?
Hellfrost, yeah.
That was a great fantasy setting. Really, really well done magic system. Runepunk's really great, although I haven't played it yet. It's just a great all-purpose system. Mm-hmm. But Realms of Cthulhu is probably one of the top five source books I've read.
Wow. Yeah, I've got that one, and even our co-host that is staunchly anti-Cthulhu thinks it looks good, so that's a good sign.
It's beautifully designed, and it'd be interesting to see. They've got an Asian Adventures campaign coming out. That company, right. Found Presence Company, and
Iron Dynasty. They had pre-release copies at Gen Con.
Oh, did they? Oh, yes. Shoot, man. I'm so pissed off.
Talk to Sean Preston. I'm sure they've got more.
Oh, and I just read Interface Zero by Gunmetal Games. I thought that was really well done.
Oh yeah, that one. I do.
That's their cyberpunk setting, and I think that's pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and now this is a personal curiosity question, sort of talking a little bit about leverage again. What were your sources of inspiration for that show and sort of the creative process in creating leverage?
Well, I'll tell you, what happened is Chris Downey and I were drinking in my garage, which is not as sad as it sounds. It's a very nice garage. And talking about a bunch of shows at the time, this was three years ago. Like Thief and a couple of the other heist and con shows had come and gone. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the fact that they were really great, but they're heavily serialized, and you don't think that's why, and they were very gritty. And that's not why you watch heist and con shows. You watch them for the magic trick. Mm-hmm. You know, you watch Ocean's 11 to see how they pull it off. Right. You know? And so we were like, where's that show? Where's the fun heist con show? And at the same time, where's the show you can watch with your dad? I mean, we came of age with the Rockford Files. The Rockford Files is the touchstone for every writer who's 40. Every male writer will tell you it's the Rockford Files. You know, it was beautifully plotted. James Garner was the perfect American hero. Just boom. Mm-hmm. And we always say that, you know, if television were one long timeless continuum, Leverage would be on Friday nights between It Takes a Thief and Rockford Files. Yeah, that's the slot. And so, coincidentally, Dean Devlin, I had worked on the Librarian System movies with him. Dean Devlin was having a meeting with TNT, and they said, we want a series out of you now that you've done these miniseries. And just blind coincidence, Dean Devlin and I had lunch like the next day. Mm-hmm. And Dean said, I want to do a team show. And I said, well, coincidentally, my friend Chris and I are thinking about this. And unlike the great Mad Men, Matt Weiner, I had the script in my backpack for 4 years story. We literally like broke it and sold it in a month and then wrote it and then shot it that fall. And then we had to wait 4 or 5 months while the writer's strike resolved. We actually shot it right before the writer's strike. Then we couldn't touch it for like 5 months.
Right.
And then the day of the writer's strike, it was actually cut and edited and delivered without us.
Right.
And then it was the day the writer's strike wrapped, they picked up the show.
Very nice.
And so the inspirations are very much, I have no problem saying that it is a retro, late 60s show. It is pulp. It is meant to be fun and a little over the top. You know, Dean Devlin has this great thing. He says, we're not 3 feet off the ground. We're 6 inches off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with being 6 inches off the ground.
Yeah, I think when I first saw the teasers and the trailers for it, my initial reaction was that it was The Sting, the series.
Yeah, I mean, we like to try to be that. I mean, the thing is, we blow stuff up a lot more. It's kind of morphed as the show, as we found what we did and you know, found that we could do some bigger action stuff. It kind of, like this year, the season finale in the winter kind of veers into Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's episodes that veer into A-Team, and then there's episodes that are pure Rockford Files, just straight up Rockford Files. You know, we're just really all over the map because, you know, we're lucky enough to have a studio, a Dean Devlin, and a network, TNT, that will let us, you know? And Dean directs a lot of the episodes, and he has a very finely honed sense of, you know, what makes the show a success. That is just, you know, giving people something to cheer about and care about.
Excellent. Well, the last question I have for you is something I ask everybody. One thing Gamers Haven is all about is sort of spreading the love of the hobby and sort of the appreciation of the tabletop gaming. What is it that about tabletop gaming and this hobby that you love?
Oh, the community. Absolutely the fact that you get together with a bunch of friends and you storytell. And you know, this is the closest we'll get to a lot of ancient art forms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my favorite things is Will Wheaton one time wrote about playing D&D with his kids.
Right.
And I said, you know, in a world where everyone's like, oh, you know, the world's falling apart, kids do nothing but play video games, he was basically talking about a father sitting down with his sons and telling stories for like 5 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. That is a hobby that is unique and is a bonding experience between generations and between friends that nobody else has, mm-hmm. that you can't duplicate in any other medium, and really doesn't succeed except for when you can sit down and talk to your friends. And actually, it's funny, I actually Skyped into a game when I was up in Portland. I Skyped into my Sunday game on the video Skype, and they put it on the laptop and sat me down at my chair.
Nice.
And it totally worked. It was totally like I was there. I could see everybody at the table, and it was great.
Yeah, we're gonna be trying something like that with a friend of ours out in Ohio in an upcoming superhero game. So
you know what? If you get the Skype video up and you just put him on the laptop and sit his butt down, mm-hmm. and I got one of the dice roller programs on my iPad.
Right.
So because I didn't bring dice with me, and it was one of those things where it's like, you know, I forgot. I'd been in the hotel room for 3 weeks at that point, mm-hmm. and I'd just forgotten what it's like to be able to sit around with a bunch of people who love the same things you love, and just you know, tell stories and play games and make fun of each other for those couple hours a week. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of other things that let you do that other than church.
Right.
You know?
All right. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time out to talk to us here at Gamers Haven. We do appreciate it.
No, my pleasure entirely. Anytime, man. Take care.
Paying attention now?
Yes.
All right. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone, where we don't know what we're talking
about. Hey, we do know what we're talking about. You know, we called the whole Hugo Weaving Red Skull thing, remember?
Oh, right. Fine. Where was it? The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about all kinds of gaggles.
Aaron, could you cut it with the gaggles thing? It's not working for me.
All right. Fine. The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games.
Don't forget that we talk about, you know, Bruce Campbell and Christopher Lee, obviously.
Natalie Portman.
All right, guys! I'm trying to do a commercial for the Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games, tabletop gaming, all kinds of other geek stuff.
You mean that show we broadcast on Ustream?
Yes!
Wednesday, 8 Central Standard Time.
Right, at redphonezone.com. Now, can you guys just give me a minute to get this promo done?
Sure, sorry, dude.
Yeah.
All right, from the top. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone.
Aaron, we need a tiebreaker. Okay, who would win in a fight with Galactus?
Anti-Monitor.
Galactus and Anti-Monitor. Come on.
I think the more important question would be who would win in a fight between me and you two idiots.
Well, I guess we don't know what we're talking about.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.